My guest is theater and literary critic Richard Gilman. He's written a memoir about a side of life even many of his friends didn't know about, his conversion from Judaism to atheism to Catholicism to what he now calls a near-total state of disbelief. His memoir is titled Faith, Sex, Mystery. He says that he came into the church because of death and left it because of sex. Gilman converted to Catholicism in 1953 at the age of 28. 8 years later, he left the church, concluding it held no place for him, either sexually or intellectually. Although it has been 25 years since his deconversion, the issues that brought him into the church remain important to him. Richard Gilman has been a theater critic for Commonweal, the Catholic literary magazine, and Newsweek. He's past president of PEN, the Society of Writers, and is now a professor at the Yale School of Drama. His earlier books include The Making of Modern Drama, Decadence, and The Confusion of Realms. Richard Gilman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Did your initial attraction to religion baffle many of your secular friends?
No, not really. I had grown up, or at least from college on, had as most of my friends, people who were looking for something, questing, you know. And as I say in the book, I at one time or another was a Freudian, a Marxist, a D.H. Laurentian, you know, all kinds of things. And while religion was not, to be a member of a religion, a formal believer, was not the in thing at the time. It didn't baffle anybody among the people I knew. What would have baffled most of them had they known later, and some of course did, was that I would do anything serious about it. You know, to be interested in religion is one thing; to become religious is another.
You were born into Judaism. When you became religious, how come you didn't become a religious Jew?
Well, as I say in the book, I had a perfunctory Jewish upbringing. You know, I went to Hebrew school and I was bar mitzvahed and went to synagogue on the holy days. My mother and father were, I would say, perfunctory, nominal Jews. My grandparents were quite religious. But I didn't grow up in a religious home at all, and I never really learned anything about Judaism as a religion. Essentially, what it was in one sense, a tribal reality. And I never was interested in it as a religious thing, and it slipped away from me very quickly once I was bar mitzvah and reached 14, 15, at which point I declared myself a very adamant atheist, which was partly a political stance, you know, at the time. But for the next 10 years or so, I investigated passionately every kind of system of belief. I was looking for something.
What did you find in Catholicism that you didn't find in other places?
Well, I found truth, what I considered to be truth. There is a very strange, well, not so strange, something has happened in questions of intellect and questions of value. Probably for the last couple of hundred years, which is that the truth of a proposition or of an idea isn't the crucial thing. The relevance of it is. And I was convinced through a rather lengthy and arduous process of thought and experience, as I describe in the book, that Catholic claims to be the repository of truth in the very basic sense were justified. I joined the church essentially not for sentimental reasons, certainly not for emotional reasons, essentially for on the basis of the fact that once I saw something as true, it seemed to me that I had to act on it. It took me a long time, as you remember from the book.
One of the things you write about very candidly in the book is your mixed feelings about certain sexual fantasies that you had, a very kind of slight masochistic type of fantasy that you had. Did you experience guilt about that, and did that feed into your wanting to enter the church?
I had, when I was growing up, when I was in my teens and early 20s and so forth, the world was rather different. Society was rather quite different. There are things that I felt guilty about and ashamed of that would scarcely make anyone ashamed or guilty today, you know. I had certain fetishes. I had certain tastes in, you know, in women. I admired strong, aggressive women. The kind of thing which certainly didn't hurt anybody. I felt guilty essentially because I grew up in an era when a great many things were taboo, and were not discussed, and were not permitted. And my father was a particular Puritan, as I say, touch on in the book. I had a very difficult time reconciling my sexual nature with the church's commandments, but that difficulty, I think, would have been the same whatever my sexual proclivities were. For example, I have gotten a number of letters from gay people, mostly gay men, but one or two women also, who've read my book and who tell me that they're very grateful that someone has come out and candidly talked about sexual difficulties in relation to moral commandments or religious commandments. And while my particular situation was not theirs, they appreciated that sort of thing in my book. And that meant a lot to me.
Well, actually, sex had a lot to do with your leaving the church.
Exactly.
But I want to come back to that.
Sure.
in a few minutes.
Sure.
Let's talk a little bit more about your entry into the church.
Yeah.
Now, you were brought up in a Jewish household. It
yes.
wasn't a very religious Jewish
no.
household, but still, I mean, certainly it was a secular Jewish household.
Yes.
Many Jews are really uncomfortable around Christian religious practices.
Sure.
And I wonder what it was like for you to enter church for the first time
yes.
as a converted Catholic, mm. knowing what your parents would have thought.
Oh, sure. Oh, it was very difficult. I grew up with, I would guess, sharing a very widespread feeling of suspicion, fear, hatred, of what my family called, and you know, and that my milieu was called the goy or the Gentile or you know the others. And as I talk again in the book, there were certain images that were very oppressive to me. The church itself, physical churches, nuns, for example, that whom I thought were sort of black apparitions from some dark area, priests, certain words. That troubled me greatly. Oh, I had to overcome a great deal before I could actually, you know, go into the church. As I say in the book, too, what was very fortunate for me, I think, was that when I actually was baptized, I was out in Colorado Springs, and I started to go to a very small Mexican-American church, a very simple church, in which almost all the parishioners were Mexican-Americans and generally a lot of old women. Some couple of quite gentle priests. The whole feeling there was far more, far simpler and far less involved with the kinds of images and practices that I had, that had disturbed me before. So I sort of slipped in a better way than it might have been elsewhere. But I did have a great deal to overcome in my mind. I there's a line, I think, in the book where I talk about the presences that sat or moved in my mind, images, words. To which I had very reflexive responses of coming from a very early age.
Theater and literary critic Richard Gilman is my guest. He's written a memoir titled Faith, Sex, Mystery. Converts are in a unique position. Usually people in a religion share a cultural past with the people mm-hmm. who they come to pray with. But when you're a convert, you don't have that shared
right.
past. You're brand new
That's exactly
to this
right.
tradition. Did you feel like you were sticking out and
yes,
different?
Yes, I felt, well, there were two kinds of feelings I had. One was that I had slipped in and it didn't matter where I came from. Because when I did become a Catholic, I almost immediately went to the extreme left, if you want to call it that, of Catholicism. Politically, socially, I started to write for a magazine on the left. I got associated with things like Dorothy Day's Catholic Worker, that kind of thing. A liberal Catholicism, you can call it that, which was a big help to me because I had always had that feeling about the church that a lot of people have, liberals, had that the church stood for reaction, fascism, you know, that sort of thing. There were times when I felt like an interloper. I felt like I didn't belong. Sure, and I had that sense of not having shared in the background. But part of that that I didn't share in the ethnic background because it's not easy to separate ethnic realities from religious ones. For example, growing up in an Italian family or a Polish family or an Irish family. So that I saw it as a question of both ethnic difference and religious difference. But at the peak of my belief, and that, it lasted, you know, for some years, which is to say when I was believing fervently and practicing ardently, the spiritual realities transcended any sense of social dislocation.
Do you remember the first time you accepted communion and what that
yes.
felt like?
Yes, I described it. I always had difficulty with communion. The question of the wafer being the, you know, the body and blood of Christ, the whole phenomenon of transubstantiation. I had difficulty with it. I knew it was essential, crucial element of Catholic practice. And I remember watching the people go before I took communion. I used to go to church and sit in the back and watch, you know, before I was actually baptized. And I would watch them, and I would see, and they looked very peculiar, as though they were all, many of them looked like they were sleepwalking, and others looked like they had just experienced some very grave event. And I found it very difficult to think that I could do that. Anyway, I finally went up to the altar. It was in this church, little church in Colorado Springs. And opened my mouth and accepted the wafer, and must have been in a kind of catatonia because I don't remember how I felt. I remember walking back to my seat in the pew and swallowing the wafer and wondering what I had done. I never quite could accept the thing. I accepted the practice. I could never quite get over the sense of the mystery, and I suppose it eventually, of course, is a mystery of what it was that it did. I know that it's a there was a gap between my rational perception of the thing, you know, taking communion and my actual experience of it.
During the first part of your stay in the church as a converted Catholic, you were feeling a lot from it. When you were getting the most from it,
yes.
what was it you were getting?
Well, I was getting a sense of priorities. I was getting a sense of being, well, I described it as being carried by up drafts of grace, of being sustained by a reality beyond myself, greater than myself, you know, all those kinds of things. I felt that my will was supported. I could will effectively. I could act the way I thought I should act. It's the only period of my life, and this lasted several years, in which I felt that my whole being, my psychic, my intellectual, my emotional selves were cohesive and moving together, and that didn't last, but it was there for a while.
You felt that integrated, but were you able to tell your parents that you converted?
I never told my parents, and I explain again in the book why. My parents were not Orthodox Jews. They were not very religious Jews, but they were very psychologically Jewish. And I didn't have a good relation with my father. But apart from that, I felt that there was no point in my telling them. They would not have understood. They would have felt offended. They would have felt affronted. They would have just about exploded or fainted or something. And I felt that there was not much point in telling them. I didn't believe then, and I don't believe now, in the primary virtue of what that fashionable word, sincerity. We should be sincere, you know. Sincerity hides a lot of spiritual pride. It hides a lot of arrogance and so on. I saw no reason for hurting them, and I saw no gain or value in that kind of sincerity in telling them. They suspected, they knew, especially when I started writing for a Catholic magazine called Jubilee, and then later Commonwealth.
A clue.
They must have had some. I told them that these magazines did employ some non-Catholic writers, but I think they were so happy that I finally had a job, because I had not had a job. I was drifting through my 20s as what I used to call an intellectual bum or hobo. And so they were so pleased that I finally had a job that I think they would have swallowed anything. But in any case, I didn't tell them.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds. My guest is Richard Gilman. He's a drama and literary critic. We're talking about the subject of his new memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery. This is Fresh Air. Richard Gilman is my guest. We're discussing his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery, about his conversion from Judaism to atheism to Catholicism to what he now calls a near-total state of unbelief. Richard Gilman is a professor at the Yale School of Drama. Let's talk about your falling out with the religion. I think one of the things you found most frustrating was the church's view of sex and contending with your own sexual desires. Could you, for instance, accept masturbation as a sin? This was not a concept you were used to.
I could accept it as a sin because it had been presented to me in a secular way as a kind of crime. In other words, something you were not supposed to do.
Sure, because a lot of children were always told you'd either get pimples or
I was told something really terrible would happen to me.
Exactly, my
mother was filled with threats that something really awful would happen to me. I accepted it as a sin, but I had trouble with it even there. I had trouble always reconciling the sexual aspects, well, the aspects of what are gathered under the rubric, the title lust, sins of the flesh, you know, lust. I think that obviously sexual sins are for many Catholics and much of the church as an institution and for many religions the most serious, the prime sin, and I don't think so. I've never thought so. I think that sexual sins can, for example, formal sexual sins, sins of lust, can have in them love, they can have in them generosity, they can have in them compassion and a sense of humanity, a sense of mortality and so on. In other words, they can have virtues in them that other sins like gluttony or avarice or cruelty, you know, do not have. And the church's emphasis, which is what I encountered, I think it has changed, I would imagine, certainly in the United States, changed for the better. It's not nearly as monolithic as it once was. Hence the American church's quarrel with the Vatican over things like abortion, you know, that sort of thing. The greatest trouble I had was to deal with what I thought of as the inflexibility, the abstract condemnation of certain acts, which I felt needed to be seen in a more supple, a more complex way, and a more compassionate way.
We keep quoting St. Augustine as saying, "God, send me chastity, but not yet."
Yes.
But I get the feeling that in your own life, you didn't want to have to totally sacrifice the flesh in order to find spirituality.
Exactly. I thought I should, in a way, not sacrifice it completely, but... But, for example, I was married much of that time, and I had problems with my wife. I had, on an occasion, I would go outside marriage and, you know, in other words, commit what was called technically adultery. I felt that my particular sexuality would be even more difficult for the church to accommodate. I remember thinking of Jesus sitting up on his throne in heaven and rolling his eyes in shock and horror at my particular fantasies, which, of course, is an absurd notion. But as I said before, I think no matter what my sexuality was, it would have come into conflict with the church. And that's the kind of response I've gotten from a lot of people who've written me, you know, about the book, that they experienced much of the same thing.
Well, I think for a lot of people who are religious or slightly religious, the conflict comes up between sexuality and religion, mm-hmm. or between some other belief or passion that they have in religion. And the question becomes, do you stay and fight off your impulses, or do you accept your impulses and leave the religious institution?
Yes, of course, that's the question. There was another aspect of my quarrel or battle with the church, and that was what I do call my ambition or my ambitiousness. When I came in the church, I felt a great relief from the burden of selfness, you know. burden of ambition, the burden of competitiveness, the feeling that I want to make a place for myself in the world. I was very ambitious, and I had a for quite a time, I was very content to sort of labor anonymously, not worry about making a name for myself. And then gradually, as I got into my 30s, and I had literary ambitions and had had them, which I'd squelched, which I'd simply suppressed in myself. And I know it was a kind of foolish dichotomy that I or opposition that I erected there. I was taking the admonition to be humble and, you know, and to efface myself quite literally. And even though I consciously knew and was told by people I knew at the time that there was nothing irreligious or sinful in developing my talents, you know, gaining a reputation, I felt guilty over that. And finally, the ambition, the suppressed literary desires broke through, and I began to feel that this humility that I'd had before was pretty false.
What do you even talk about? A self-aggrandizing kind of humility.
Yeah. Now, you see, I still think this is something that touches on a great many things. You pointed out at the beginning of the book, you quoted the idea that I do not have any real belief today. I still have some. I have a faint, more than faint, it's there. Some kind of, for example, I'm not an atheist. I believe in God. I don't know how or what. But one thing that I got from the church, from the essence of the church, the best part of the church, was a sense of something to combat the fierce, cannibalistic almost, you know, competitiveness of our time, which is gaining all the time, the aggression, the greed, the putting of the self first, which we phenomena we see all around us, you know, and it seems to grow all the time. I remember feeling that only through this kind of principle of at least partial self-effacement or generosity, a sense of giving to others, could you combat that, what seemed to be the tide of the times, you know, the tremendous individualism, the dog-eat-dog, the man is a wolf to man, and all of that, which I felt then and see even more strongly now.
So you believe in God in a kind of, but that's where the mystery comes in. It's not, you're
yes,
not part of an organized religion,
no,
right now.
No, I don't go to church. I don't know if I ever will go back. I didn't write the book in order to go back, you know. And yet I find stirrings of various kinds.
Well, I want to ask you about art, too. I mean, because one of the things you've really struggled with throughout most of your adult life are questions of religion. You've also struggled with questions of art, and I'm sure there's some connection there for you. Because let me remind our listeners that you're a literary critic, you're a drama critic, you've been writing almost all of your adult life, and you were a passionate reader even when you were a child.
Yes. Well, I think it's true to say that for me, for a long time, and to a certain extent now, not nearly as strongly, art was a kind of religion. And I think that was true and has been true for a lot of people. I think less now, but it certainly was true. It began to be true probably a couple of hundred years ago. And I think it developed in the 19th century. And in our time, and particularly with what we call modernism, the sense of art as a way of belief, a way of dealing with experience, literature particularly, but the other arts too, was this kind of substitute religion or a pseudo or quasi-religious experience. Though I think that there is a strong connection of a very fundamentally good kind between art and religion, I think, because both deal with the impalpable, both deal with realms of reality beyond the immediately provable, beyond the scientific, beyond the ascertainable. There's a remark that I'm very fond of quoting. I was quoted to my students by the French writer Charles Péguy, who described what he called the bourgeois mind, and by bourgeois he didn't mean necessarily any economic level, a kind of mind, he said, that always and inevitably prefers the visible to the invisible. And I think that art, in a way, and religion in its way, offers the invisible as a kind of alternative to the palpable, the known, the visible.
Well, you know, in that connection between art and religion, many religions use art in a way to for as part of the religious experience through hymns and songs and paintings and iconography
and cathedrals.
Literature.
And there was, of course, a time in human history in which art and religion were very closely united, fused almost.
You know, I want to ask you one last thing. You almost apologize to your readers at the end of your memoir for giving them nothing definitive, no calls to order, no models for behavior, no moral resting place. But it seems to me that finally that's what your experience is about. It's about continually questing for some kind of answers to big questions, but not finding pat answers.
Right. Well, I think that came... I had the sense that and perhaps I was silly to worry about this, but I have a feeling that in books of this kind, the broad genre, people are looking for some kind of answer, and of course they get very cheap ones, you know, from lots of people. Some kind of thing. Now I'm this, and now I'm that, and by implication, this is what you should be, and this is what you might do, and so forth. I came out with no conclusion. I am still, as I said, peddling in midair. I don't. I have no answers. And it's interesting that a number of letters that I've gotten from people have told me that that's fine, it's all right, they didn't want me to, you know, that it would have been false if I'd come out with some denouement, you know, some final conclusion and saying, this is it, this is the truth. I don't know.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your experiences with us today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Richard Gilman's latest book is Faith, Sex, Mystery. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.